Well, we're actually in the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, New York City, June 1969, which is usually seen as the starting point for a new wave of gay militancy, of the birth of the gay liberation movement. What was Stonewall? There's lots of myths around it. There's lots of different historical interpretations. But essentially, there was a riot at the Stonewall Inn in New York City, in Greenwich Village in New York City, a bar that had been raided many times by the police. And on this particular occasion, which happened to be the night of the death of Judy Garland, the faggots and queens in the pub, in the bar, fought back. And there were several nights of riots, and the police essentially were outnumbered, and that was the symbolic starting point of a new militant movement. The Gay Liberation Front in New York City was founded soon after. It's worth saying that it didn't come out of anywhere. There had been a new militancy in the gay world in America throughout the 60s, and even the phrase gay is good was being used before Stonewall. But the way the historical memory works, we much prefer to see a symbol of what happened. And Stonewall inspired, the image, the myth of Stonewall, inspired a host of movements. First of all, in neighboring countries, Canada, then in Britain in 1970, moving to Australia, New Zealand. There was already in France militancy which had come out of 1968, and FAR represented that. And the full impact of gay liberation, I think, came later in Paris, later in the 1970s. Nevertheless, by 1972, 1973, there was an international network of gay liberation movements, not all tracing back to Stonewall, but I think making use of the image of the myth of Stonewall as a mobilizing factor. I mentioned Judy Garland because there is something symbolic, and historians have seen something symbolic about gay liberation in effect starting the night she died, because Judy Garland, in a sense, represented a particular queer consciousness in the 1950s and 1960s. She was always a great heroine, certainly in Britain, of queers. And the fact she died on the night that something different began to happen, I think, has a certain poignancy, at the very least, and a certain symbolic significance over and above that. I very carefully used the word queer about what happened before Stonewall. Queer represented a term of abuse, but it was a term that most of my generation had internalized, and we used it in a self-mocking way. The new term with gay liberation, certainly in the English-speaking world, was gay, of course. And gay represented something new. Language is always very important in sexuality, and the language you use signifies the way we see the world, the way we see ourselves. So the use of a different word, of gay, which had had a subcultural influence in America and England before that, was represented something new. Now, of course, what confuses the issue is that queer is used today in a quite different sense from the way it was used before 1969. So I try very carefully to use the language that was used at the time, and I'll try not to confuse you when I switch from one to the other. I remind myself that I was asked a question 15 minutes ago, which I have failed to answer, which was essentially about what do I mean by social constructionism. It's an old phrase I like particularly. It has a harsh mechanical tone about it. It's a word that was imposed upon me. I was described as a social constructionist rather than originally defining myself as a social constructionism. But labels are labels, and we adopt them or we reject them. Essentially, what I meant by social constructionism was the idea that sexual identities, sexual concepts, sexual beliefs are formed in particular cultures. They don't belong to the realm of nature, they belong to the realm of history. And my little mention of the changing language is a prime example of that. Because the way we see ourselves is reflected in the language we use about ourselves. And the move from queer to gay and back to queer in a different sense over the last 50 years represents really dramatic changes in the way we see sexuality. We see sexuality and gender as concepts shaped in history, and we see them as the basis for self-identification and collective identities. So the social aspect of constructionism, the emphasis on the social, which I prefer to construction, is actually simply saying sexuality is a historical phenomenon, not a natural phenomenon. And the importance of saying that is, if you believe that sexuality is simply a natural phenomenon, then we're fixed in nature and no change is ultimately possible. If you recognize that the way we see ourselves, the way we identify, the way we conceptualize sexuality is shaped in history, then you can recognize that something that is invented in history can also be changed in history. So a social explanation, a historical explanation, opens the way to understanding the role of sexuality in society and the way that changes over time. One of the disadvantages of being a historian of the contemporary world and of contemporary sexuality is that it's impossible to disguise the fact that one is much older now than one was then. I'm talking in many ways about the history of my life, which is an odd thing to be a historian of. Of course I've done research in other periods, and that's very important in understanding sexuality. But I do think that I've been fortunate enough to live through a period of extraordinary change in attitudes towards sexuality and gender and the host of things associated with that. And what I've always been anxious to do is to develop the intellectual tools and the political understanding, the two I think go together, to understand these remarkable changes that I'm going through, that I've gone through. But the fact that things have changed so rapidly in my lifetime is an important insight, I think, into the ways in which things changed in the past. There's no reason to think that the changes we've gone through are unique in history. You can look at different historical periods and see tremendous changes in relationship to the way sexuality is organized, controlled, regulated, and lived. And that insight into the mobility of sexualities is a crucially important thing that the sexual historian, the historian of sexuality, needs to understand.